gentlemen, welcome to the first live episode of the Wine Centric Show. Yeah. Right here in Fenton and Cary, North Carolina. So we are at BBQ and Bubbly. And for those that don't know, on the Wine Centric Show, we talk to the titans of the wine business, the titans of the world, the movers, the shakers, the luminaries. They enlighten everything and they make it go. And I started this show back in October. And one of the first persons I called to be on the show, I was sitting outside of Dave & Buster's as my kids were on a birthday party. And I called Andre and I said, man, I'm doing this thing. And we took up the whole hour of why my kids were in the birthday party. And he told me about why I should do it and who's doing it and who's not doing well and how he did it. This man is an inspiration. He is the only two-time guest already of the Wine Centric Show. And it's about to be three. That's how much he has to say. Exactly.
Oh, hold on.
Yeah.
I learned that from my 9-year-old, sorry.
So without further ado, the man from Bon Appetit's World of Wine, he is the Mac Man, Mr. Andre Mac!
Awesome, thank you. All right, so I'm never really formal with this shit, so I'm going to tell you how we kind of do it. So this is a master class, we're calling it that. Obviously, you're not going to master anything in 35 minutes. But ideally, what we wanted to take you through is what sparkling wine is. I think a lot of people are confused, and you know, we call things that are champagne that aren't, but what we're really talking about is sparkling wine. And so we thought what would be really cool is to break down, you know, four different styles of sparkling wine and what they are, talk about them, taste about them, and then we want to leave a small little room at the end, maybe 7 or 8 minutes for questions. Doesn't have to be questions about this, be questions about anything that you want to answer. So, and I kind of go kind of fast. If you've ever watched my show, we do a lot of editing, right? Because I just talk a whole bunch of shit, and then they have to go back, right? I'll go ahead and pour. Because as Matt says, my shit's not funny if they're not drinking. So we want to make sure that everybody has something to drink. I'm excited to be here in North Carolina, in Raleigh. This is my favorite area. I guess what I want to say is, my real job, I just don't play a sommelier on television. I do it in real life. But also, I make wine. I started a wine company called, it was originally called Mouton Noir Wines, and then I was in an 8-year-long legal battle with one of the most prestigious wine companies in the world called Mouton Rothschild. So fuck those guys. We're gonna get that on camera. Hey, all right. Hey, 6 years is a long time. A lot of money. But anyways, I changed the name to Maison Noir Wines. I've made wine since 2007. So the idea was, I was a sommelier. I got into wine by watching old episodes of Frasier. That inspired me to have wine in my life. That inspired me to actually go into a wine shop for the first time in my life. And based upon that, I caught what people call in the industry called the wine bug. Every waking moment I spent thinking about wine, tasting wine, and then I started to study wine. And then in a very short time, in 18 months from starting to study wine, I was one of the sommeliers at the French Laundry. At the time, which was named the number one restaurant in the world. And then from there, I moved to New York, sight unseen, to run the beverage department at Per Se, which is Thomas Keller's second restaurant. It was the most anticipated restaurant opening in New York City history. And something told me that I was like, Andre, I think you need to go. And I show up to New York. I ran the beverage department there for 3 years. Like all great stories, they involve a woman. I met my wife there. We had a strict no fraternization policy there. So it was a really secret romance. My wife left to write a book, a New York Times bestselling book called Service Included. That left me a little bit of a pinch. I was part of management. I find myself in the manager's meeting, and my girlfriend's name is on the agenda. And I'm like, shit. You know, my mom did tell me about sitting where you eat at. You know what I mean? I was like... and so that, I have to say that I didn't get pushed out, but it felt like that was the impetus to move on. A job like the job I had, it's one of the top ones in your field, and people, they don't come a dime a dozen, and people just don't leave them. It was that thing that I wanted to continue to learn about wine, but I wanted to learn it from outside of the four walls of the restaurant. I had a hankering, like I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I wanted to have more creativity in my life. I think as a sommelier, you're more of a curator. Right, we collect other people's stories and we put them on a list. I don't make anything. A bartender is more as closer to a chef than we are because they make something. It's the reason why you like your margarita made by Timmy and not by Tom, right? It's because they do something special or whatever they do. And I took the leap of faith to say, hey, I'm going to leave and I want to go make wine. And I left. A job that was really great. I had no money. I didn't have a business plan. And somehow it all worked out. I wrote an email to everybody I ever worked with. You know, I'm a real firm believer in putting it out in the universe and letting the universe co-conspire to make you help. Shit happened. Sorry. So, long story short, I've been making wine in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest for years. I spent a lot of time on the road, a decade traveling. Almost every single week I went to the airport. And so I've done a lot of this. I spent a lot of time in this area. I love this area. Actually, I love it. This is my favorite part of North Carolina. I don't really mess with Charlotte, but right? Let's talk about sparkling wine, and let's kind of move in. So have you guys started sipping? You got some left? Hold on, let me make sure I'm in here. And sparkling wine is made in the same way that most wine is made. So we talk about a still wine, right? So that wine is made. It goes through a fermentation. But so when we talk, so you have a still wine ready, and then what you do is you add yeast and sugar back into the wine, and then you cap it off in the bottle, and it referments. That's how, and so you trap the bubbles. So the whole idea is like there's lots of different things. Dom Perignon, right? So we know this monk, this famous monk, the friar, right? The whole idea of what he discovered was the secondary fermentation when you trap bubbles inside of the bottle. So there's different methods that you can use. That's called the traditional method, right? Where you use yeast and you put it back in the bottle. The second method is called the tank method. And so imagine a huge tank that's the size of this room. And then they pressurize the tank and then they make the bubbles in that and then they bottle it. So that's one method. So that's number two. And then number three is kind of the other method. It's kind of cheating. They just inject it with carbonation. Right, and you can really kind of tell the difference because they use what's called the injection method, and it's not as robust, it's not as strong, and it kind of fizzles over time like a soda, right? So you know, like a soda doesn't stay hard carbonated at the beginning. Like when you open a soda and you start to drink it, you're like, wow, it doesn't really quench your thirst because of the bubbles, right? And it's really hard to drink. But if you let it sit for a little bit, then it becomes easier, and then after a while, it just becomes flat, and that happens very quickly, and that's what a lot of those wines. So you see, like inexpensive sparkling wines tend to have that. Some sweet wines tend to have that. But I want to take you through the methods and taste some of the wines so we can kind of talk about this. So first up, we have a sparkling wine called Joe Landrin. That's what you have in your glass now. It's called Atmospheres. And this is from the Loire Valley. And we can get technical about where they are, but these are producers that I like, but not specifically that we need to talk about them. But if you have questions about them, we will. But this is a sparkling wine from the Loire. And to me, you know, when I taste this wine, you know, it's like green apples, pear. It's very aromatic, right? So you want to put your nose in the glass. And normally what I tell people, okay, like we're tasting them out of plastic cups, it's fine, right? Like we don't have to have a sim. We don't have to worry about heating up the wine. Like this is 30 minutes. And I probably got like 15 left. Sorry. Okay. Right. This is like speed dating. Okay. All right. So we want to put your nose in the glass here. I got a big nose. So you can nose just fit in there. Here we go. And you want to inhale through your nose and exhale through your mouth, right? And that really opens up your olfactory senses, right? Because 80% of taste is actually smell. And I learned that when I had to eat Brussels sprouts when I was a kid, right? I did a lot of this right here. But I have like white flowers. And actually, it smells kind of sweet. You know, when I say that, I say, you know, confectionery. So it smells like cotton candy if you put your nose in it. And wine is so subjective, and it's always weird because people are like, I don't smell cotton candy. Well, I know that it smells like cotton candy because when I was 17, I had a job at Chuck E. Cheese, and I used to make a cotton candy in the morning. And so this is kind of what this smells like. And then you want to give it a taste. So it's pretty bone dry. In my opinion, it's bone dry. You taste a little bit of like the white peach, a little bit of golden apple. It has some acidity. When we talk about acidity, you accentuate acidity on the sides of your tongue. Your sides of your tongue will tingle, and then you'll start to salivate. So right now when I'm talking, I'm like, I gotta swallow now because it might go flying everywhere, right? So the idea is that when you, acidity, to me is, when I talk about acid and acidity, I think most people kind of cringe because we're thinking about like battery acid or things that you put on things. Acid is an amplifier. Like the reason why you put salt on food and lemon on like seafood and those things is to amplify the flavors of a dish. right? That's when someone's like, hey, who made the potato salad? And then they reach for the salt, right? And then they put it on there because that's when they talk about the food is bland. They can't taste the flavors, and you have to put some seasoning on it. And it lifts, alcohol is like the, it's like the volume dial, like when you want to crank up the flavors of a dish. And so a lot of these wines have that, but this is one example that I feel like is a great sparkling wine that kind of over-delivers for the price point. And so when we start to talk about, so what I've learned and what I can tell you, the more times that the winery or the winemaker has to touch it, the more money that you'll have to spend on it, right? So like the less time. So if they do it in a tank, then that means it's not in bottles, which means that it's in bulk, so to speak. It comes out less for the consumer. But in Champagne, where they touch every single bottle, you've seen them with the white gloves and they're like doing the riddling, like that thing. That is why Champagne costs so much as it does. Yes?
Which grapes did you use or are used in this one?
Yeah, so this is actually Folie Blanche. It's a grape called Folie Blanche, right? And generally, I think that's a grape also that's used in, by another name, that's used in cognac. But it's not a grape varietal that, like, it's not like Chardonnay or Pinot Noir. And if I had to give it a guess, like, to try to compare it to, it's like maybe Sauvignon, like a cross between, like, Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay. But, like, and we can talk about the grapes that they're in as well, and that lends to some of the flavor as well. But a lot of these grapes aren't grapes that we're familiar with, and they're, pardon me, oh, that's a sparkling one there. We need a Tums sponsorship, too, while we're at it. And so a lot of the grapes are indigenous grapes. Right, so when you think of something like Cava, right, which is like Spain's version of Champagne, which we're going to move on to next, that, you know, those are using local grapes there that we may not know. They're not as prevalent as some of the noble grapes that we might know. All right, so now we're going to move on. So this is the Loire Valley in France. You know, this is all the hipsters and all the young kids. Like, this is a hot region, and I wanted to be able to have some of those wines so you could be able to taste those. And then now we're going to move on to Cava. We thought we'd do a little rosé. And then we'll move on to that. Cava is done in the same way, the traditional method, where it's actually done in bottle. It's done in bottle, but it's a little bit different. So, like, the secondary fermentation happens in a bottle. So you make a still wine, you add all the sugars and the yeast, and then it starts to ferment, and they trap it in the bottle. And then what happens is, instead of in Champagne. And I keep doing this, and when you're going to go home and you're going to look it up and you see a video and you know exactly what I'm talking about. It looks really weird, right? But, like, they have what's called a riddling rack. And so it's a wooden rack that's built like a triangle. There's nothing in between, and it's like this. And on this side, both sides, they have holes in them on both sides. And what you do is the bottles are put in like this at an angle. And so it's all filled up with bottles on both sides. And then what you have is each day they come in and give the bottles a quarter turn. And that helps the yeast fall to the end of, to the top of the bottle, right? So all the dead yeast cells fall here and get trapped in the neck, right? And so they do the hand riddling like that, and then what happens is they do disgorgement. And so disgorgement, I'm using these technical terms, but, like, disgorgement is, like, how do they get all the dead yeast cells out of the bottle because they did the second term for infection? And this was done by, this was a technique that was invented by Madame Veuve Clicquot. So you know Veuve Clicquot? It was a woman who owned that champagne house. And what they would do is they'd take the bottles like this and they would put it in the snow outside, and then it would freeze. So this part would freeze, and then they would open it up and it would shoot out the dead yeast cells. Then they put it back up, they top it off with regular wine, and then they cork it. Right, so that's a real only. So in Cava, what they do is they use a big old machine called a gyrator, and it does the same thing as riddling, but it's not by hand. There's someone hit me, you got it? But anyways, so take a sip, and you guys let me know, and then we'll come back and talk about it. She's going to hit me up here. And so we thought rosé would be just kind of a different thing, because rosé is kind of a style of wine. Even though these are sparkling wines, you know, this is a variant in it. So, like, sparkling wine can come in many different flavors, if you will, and different styles. This is made with a couple local grapes, but the major grape here is called Exilarale. I think he's got an empty glass back there. So for me, I'm smelling like, this crowd participation. What do everybody smell? Anybody smell? Give me something. Give me three fruits. Strawberries, yep. Anybody? There's no wrong answer. It smells like Big League Chew to me. You know, remember that gum, Big League Chew? It smells like bubble gum. The strawberry flavor, the dude with the purple hat on, right? Right? So, and this is what I encourage people to do. When we talk about wine, Talk about things that it reminds you of what it smells like. There's no, the only way that we evolved, it's like I use the term gooseberries, but shit, I don't know if I've ever seen a gooseberry in my life, right? You know what I mean? And so that's the old language. And I think what we start to talk about is like, you know, I remember, you know, in an exercise, somebody says, hey, she said, she goes, this mind reminds me of my grandfather. I said, so what do you mean? I said, did he wear aftershave? You know, like what was he? She's like, no, he used to have a pack of cigarillos in his shirt pocket. And when he would pick her up and hug her, that's what it smelled like. And I said, oh, so we're talking about tobacco and cedar. And so there's a way to be able to translate a lot of the language, but like, you should really be talking about like what you smell right away. So like for me, this Big League Chew, right? You know, but when we start to break it down, it's like, okay, which flavor of it? They used to have grape. That's not grape. It's strawberry. And so those are the kind of things that I feel like language around that is talking about, like exactly like what it reminds you of and how it hits you. And so, and this is really interesting. This is a lot more full-bodied, robust. Like it feels like it's, I wouldn't say powerful, but it has more body to it. Like it has more staying power when we talk about aftertaste. The first wine that we tasted, I think you tasted it and then there was no aftertaste. Like if you count like after you swallowed, how many seconds you continue to taste it is something totally different. This, you start to taste it like to at least 2 or 3 seconds. And for me, this is because of the skin contact that you have because of the red grapes here, right? That's gonna make it a little bit more powerful. And I always think that if you, in the summertime, it is a lot, you know, it's hot outside, you want something cooler to like kind of quench your thirst. And I think that's where rosé comes in. It was really fun. And also I wanted to talk about food and wine pairing. And, you know, it's always an interesting thing to me because when I first got into wine, people talked about food and wine pairing as like this spiritual thing, right? Like the clouds parted and cherubs came out and played trumpets. And that's never happened. So today, if you're walking around and off these food recommendations or anything, you have a revelation like that, please hunt me down. I'll be wearing this red hat, and please, I want to be a part of that spiritual experience. And then when I got there, I was like, shit, well, how do I explain it to people? And what's interesting to me is that when I talk about food and wine pairing, the idea of it is so that the first bite tastes as good as the last bite. And I think what we all experience is what we call palate fatigue, right? So you have a 16-ounce ribeye, and you're sitting down, and you're like, oh, my God, this looks great, and you're like into it, boom, and it's like, you got some Syrah, whatever you're drinking, you keep going. Then at one point, you probably have half the steak, a little bit of steak left, and you're like, well, shit, I can't leave it on the plate. And then now you just kind of you just go through the motions and kind of try to eat it. But what wine is there is to reset your palate back to zero. And I guess the best way to explain it, it's kind of crude, right, is let's use gum as an example. You put gum in your mouth, you start to chew it, and after 20 or 30 minutes, it has no flavor, but you continue to chew it anyway, right? It's like you're working out the jawline or whatever you're doing, right? But if you take that gum out and put it on the table, I know some of you out here, you put it underneath the table. But miraculously, if that piece of gum makes it back into your mouth, it has flavor again, right? Think about that. If you've ever done that, you chew gum, you put it aside, and if you put it back in your mouth, it will have flavor. And that's the whole idea of what we talk about palate fatigue. Right? It's like you've chewed it so much that it has no flavor. You take a break and now it's back, right? And it's that break, the wine is that break to make the first bite taste as good as the last bite. And so that's kind of what I preach and kind of how I talk to people about wine, because it's really hard to talk about the skies parting and like, you know, and a baby is playing a trumpet. You know what I mean? And generally when we talk about food and wine pairing, there's two different ways to look at it. You can compare like with like, and you can do contrast. Right, so when we say like with like, we say a creamy pasta dish, right? We'll use something like Chardonnay that's rich and round, and now we're pairing like with like, right? So it matches together. And what you could do is you could do the contrast, right? Where you can actually pair something that's more acidic and lean and light to kind of cut through the richness and the fatness of that particular dish. So there's many ways to look at it, but it's really to break up the palate fatigue so the first bite tastes as good as the last bite. And I would have to say, most cava to me is, they're not made with the traditional grapes that we were talking about, right? So Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and we'll talk about that when we get to Champagne. That's why the price is different, but they use the same method. And I have to, bless you. And I have to figure, I would say in my mind, the closest thing to Champagne, and a lot of this to me, is cava at that point. They use the same method, and that's really what you're paying for. And we'll talk more about method when we get to the Jeeper Champagne, which is right about now. So we're moving on to Champagne. So we hear a lot about this. Champagne has done a brilliant marketing brand. I think the actual, they talk a lot about stuff, but what I've heard, I'm not going to go into in detail, but a lot of it, a lot of talk and a lot of whispers say that the actual champagne method, the traditional method, actually came from Italy, and it's called Prosecco method. Look it up. I'm not going to, like, conspiracy theorists, don't quote me on this. I'm not starting no shit. But look it up. There's some conspiracies and crossover on it. But champagne is the epitome of sparkling wine. Put it this way. There's all sparkling wine, but not all sparkling wine is champagne. Right? So if you understand that. So champagne is bigger than the whole category of sparkling wine in that sense of prestige. Right? They christen ships with it. People celebrate holidays, birthdays, championships, whatever with it. It comes with this thing. It's an ultimate luxury brand. And why, when we talk about luxury, when we talked about before, the more times you touch it, the more expensive it's going to be. So the whole idea that they do hand riddling and they do all that, it can only be called champagne if it's from the Champagne region of France. And here what they use is, they use the premium grapes that we know in the world. So Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and a grape called Pinot Meunier. And depending on which different regions in Champagne, will determine what styles of grapes they use and how they bottle it and do that. What's interesting about Champagne is that it's gone through an evolution. Like before the 1990s, Champagne operates differently than it does in most of France. Most of France, they have this idea called terroir. Terroir is the taste of the land, right? And it's the wines are named after the place and not the grapes. So we say we're having a bottle of Bordeaux or a bottle of Champagne, but that's like saying, hey, I had a bottle of Napa today, right? What you say is I have a bottle of Cabernet from Napa, right? So it's named after a region. And so, and in those regions, they're specific about the grapes that are grown there, how you can put them together. Champagne was operated differently because most champagne is sourced from all of Champagne and all the different regions. And so what they had was like, is there a thing called terroir in Champagne? Because they blend from different areas. And then what you had is a small band of winemakers, and we called it Farmer Fizz, or we called it Grower Champagne, where instead of selling their grapes to the larger co-op, they decided to make their own specific grapes from the land in their front yard. And that's where things changed for Champagne, and the evolution really kind of took on another side of the story. And then American sommeliers started to adapt that. What I think is great, there are many different styles. You know, there's vintage champagne, there's non-vintage champagne. You know, and it's interesting, right? I think when we think about like brands like Veuve Clicquot and those kind of things compared to Grower Champagne, I remember talking to a famous importer, and he explained to us and the staff that Veuve Clicquot is kind of like the Frito-Lay of champagne. It's not a bad thing. I'm sure that you guys don't be offended. but in that way, explain it. And these are kind of the smaller brands. But what I really love about Champagne is kind of its consistency in a way. Like, think about Veuve Clicquot. I always say, like, it's like, why would you go to Italy and then you see a long line of people at Starbucks? Right? And I think for a lot of us, it's something that's familiar. You know what quality and what you're going to get. Like, the idea, like, you go to this place and you don't know and you get a coffee, like, you're not going to have a second coffee. Right? And so I think there's a lot of that. So Champagne is really beautiful and wonderful. And like I said, they have non-vintage, which means that they are vintage, just multiple ones together. But then they have different ones they break out. They have vintage champagne. And so most of the wine has to come from a specific vintage. And then it's aged. And so based upon that, you know, it gets in a little bit more depth. And then also they have ones that are made by different grapes. So this is Champagne Jeepers. This is called Blanc de Blanc. And this is one of my favorites. So it's white from white. And so this is actually 100% Chardonnay. So to me, these are always kind of the top cuvées that most champagne houses have. And to me, this like kind of this minerality and this depth of Chardonnay to me is just wonderful and beautiful. You guys, have we gotten in there yet? Yeah, so for me, like right off the bat, like this, it smells a little toasted. It smells like brioche. I get hazelnuts. Yeah, it's kind of doughy, but like it has an expression that we haven't had in any other ones before, right? You know, like it's got body, it's got complexity. I'm still tasting it. There's still different flavors that is kind of evolving, which I feel like this is what you pay for in champagne. This is why it's more expensive. Even though we don't, I'm not eating this food, but anyways. This is why the power of tasting them side by side is like amazing, right? Because you can discern the difference. But like this is, to me, this is the goal and this is the standard that all the other ones kind of try to stand up too. But also this comes with a price. And you can get a part of that experience at a more inexpensive price. And so why did we pair it with the slow braised, what was this in here, brisket?
Braised brisket, yeah.
So braised brisket, slow cooked, like that richness and that fattiness, that richness, and you have something like Chardonnay that carries weight, but also there's this minerality and acidity to it that kind of really cuts to it. For me, I think the ultimate wine to have with any type of cuisine is sparkling wine, right? The idea that you have these bubbles that act as like a cleaning agent that kind of scrub your palate clean in between each bite, that's why I always feel like it's great. Even something like when we talk about, you know, fried chicken, when we talk about something like caviar that's salty and briny, and we kind of go that way. Yes? Yeah, there's tons of red sparkling wines. Lambrusco, some people say Manischewitz. Hey, there's some really great producers out there now. But yeah, there's some really great versions of them that are really awesome and really fun. Even the Australians, they have a thing called Black Shook. And they've really created a culture of drinking red sparkling wines. Who did? Oh, you have. You made sparkling wine bags. It refermented in the bottle. Correct. Got it. No, totally. No, totally. So what he's talking about is, he said he made sparkling wine on accident. And what happens is you're gonna have a stuck fermentation, but sometimes, and this happens in a lot of the wine that we call natural wine. A lot of some of the natural wines, they're volatile, meaning that they're not stabilized. And so they have some yeast that are still left over. And what ends up happening is at some point, they can start to re-ferment in the bottle. And what you have is the same thing. You had a stuck fermentation, but there's a lot of people who make wine that it's still in a stuck fermentation. It hadn't finished fermentation yet, and then it re-ferments again. So that's something to look for. So last but not least, we're going to end with Prosecco. I think Prosecco, the number one market for Prosecco in the world is America. And I have to say that, well, check me. We can fact check that. And there's lots of different reasons. And I would have to say that like in the last like 15 years that it's really kind of exploded. And I think, you know, as an Americans, we're pretty simple. Prosecco, we can say that shit, right? You know what I mean? Right? It's like, you know what I mean? It's not like, I don't know how to pronounce it. And I think that helps with the ease of that. It's easy drinking. And I feel like a lot of people, you know, it's inexpensive. And I think that's kind of caught people by surprise. And I think it's great. In that sense. And so this is Ardento. This is Prosecco. This is actually made in the tank method. And then there's some producers, depending on where you're at, they go all the way up to using the traditional method. And that's when you talk about what's the difference. So you see Prosecco's on the shelf, and you can see one at 10, and you can see one at like 50 or 80. And it's basically in the method that they're made and the styles that they're made that dictate the price. I don't have any, so. Anybody want to tell me what they smell? Jolly Ranchers. Okay, which one? The green, the red, or do we got flavors? Green. So green is apple, raspberry. I definitely get apple. Like from a lot of that, you get that apple flavor. Somebody got? All right, I'm hearing some over here. Cherry. Yeah. No. Totally. I'm like. All right. So normally when I can't smell. It's not rude, as long as you don't put your hand on somebody else's glass. So a little tip, what you do is you put your hand on top of your glass, your wine glass, and you want to swirl. And when you're swirling, all you're doing is agitating the wine, letting it open up. But what you're doing is trapping the wines and think, don't be afraid. It's so funny because it's like one of those jokes from high school where they're like, hey, if your hand is bigger than your face, then you have some type of disease. And when you do that, they slap the shit out of you, right? Nobody's going to hit you. Okay? All right, go like this. Right? And then what you want to do, so now you're just trapping the vapor. And the aroma. Now you want to get close, and now you see how now it jumps out of the glass. It's amplified, right? So now what do you get? Same thing. So I think a little cherry, a little almond. It's like that Jergens lotion a little bit. Sorry. All right. So now when we taste it, like to me, out of all of these, this is the most fruit forward style wine. You get more fruit. It feels lively up front. It's very, I don't know how to say it. Like, I wouldn't say vivid, but like, it's very present that there's fruit in this wine. It kind of reminds me of the Clearly Canadian. You remember those? I'm dating myself. Remember those? They were all clear, and then you taste them, and you're like, wow, it's like so much fruit in it. This is kind of what it reminds me of. But there's a little bit of pear, there's cherry, there's some almond. And see, right about now, that would have been great with some wings. They're all sold out. I don't know if anybody else is making wings. So it's that contrast between the spice, the heat, the spice and the heat, and then the freshness of the fruit kind of coming together. And to me, it's always just a beautiful thing. But my thing is, like, I encourage everybody, you're an expert in your own taste. I'm more of a tour guide. I just know, sommeliers are tour guide. They know the wine list that they put together, right? And it's more about a conversation with the guests and you and them. Don't give up your power. You know what you like, and you're there to pay for it. Make them work for their money. Tell them what you like. Tell them what, and more importantly, tell them your price point. I think that's where it gets weird, and it's only because we make it weird. You don't have to be weird about it. You don't have to say it out loud. You can say, hey, I like to drink this stuff, and you don't have anything. I don't recognize anything on the wine list, but this is what I like to drink. And maybe have a picture, you tell them, and then what you do is you go on the wine list and you find a price point that you want to be around, and you're like, I don't want to spend more than that, or I want to be right around here. You know, guests don't have to know, but by doing that, that gives them some marching orders in a way that they can come back and you're in your budget and you can feel comfortable and you're not going to be like John Legend when they go somewhere and then they bought them a $25,000 bottle. At the end of the day, they thought it was like $250, something like that, and it was $25,000. So you don't have to worry about that if you lay out the expectations and the boundaries right at the front. But like my whole thing is that I want people to empower that. Like you don't need anybody to tell you whether you like Diet Coke or regular Coke or Pepsi or you don't like soda at all. And when it comes to wine, it's somehow because of the structure that we build, people feel like they have to bow down and give their taste to other people. And like you are, hopefully it's empowering to say that you're an expert in your own taste and you kind of move out in the world with that. Do we have any more questions? I don't know. I feel like I can go on and, yes.
So can you share about your collaboration with Proxies?
Oh, yeah, sure. Damn. Charlie would be great. Hey, Charlie, what's up, man? I know I owe you an email. So there's been this really big movement of non-alcoholic, right, wines. And I have to say that at Per Se, like in 2004, we were one of the first restaurants at that level that we had our own non-alcoholic tasting. And it was $95, so it was a lot. And we put together with teas, elixir, like we were actually making the stuff back there. And then at the tail end of COVID, you had this splurge and they have all these things. Some of it I agree with, some of it I don't. You know, like the whole thing is like, This tastes like cucumber water. It's $45. Shit, like it costs just as much as a gin, right? You know what I mean? And so I have to say that COVID proved one thing to me. It's like, I think that we'll return that. We're just hungover. The world is hungover. We drank more than our fair share. We thought the world was gonna end. And at some point you're like, holy shit, like I need to slow down. So I was approached by this Canadian company. It's a vinegar company. And they made all these different vinegars. And so it's not actually a non-alcoholic wine, right? It's proxy. So it's basically a wine proxy. So it's adjacent to wine. What most non-alcoholic wine that you have on the marketplace, is that they take a wine, they make the wine, it has alcohol in it, and then they de-alcohol it. So like it's kind of like the whole thing is like if you take wine and put it in the freezer and then it's frozen, then you take it out and put it in the refrigerator, and then open it and think it's going to be the same. It's not. It's horrible, right? That's like the de-alcoholization of wine. And so what they decided to do was like to make these proxies. And so they're vinegar-based, and then they add flavoring in it. And so they came to me and they said, hey, we would love to make something with you, do a collaboration. And so I was like, hey, I would love to make somewhat a non-alcoholic version of a wine that we make, a Pinot Noir that we make called Other People's Pinot. And so what we did was I gave them Pinot Noir juice that hadn't been fermented from us. And then we use some local stuff. They have a grape they have a berry that's local to like a raspberry called the Marion berry. So we use those, and then we use some oolong teas and all kinds of black teas to make this version of this thing. And it's pretty beautiful in a way that it's not wine, but it could be a substitute in that way. And then we use it for, in my restaurant, we used it, for people who aren't drinking, people who might be expecting and those kind of things, or taking a break. And it's a way for them to be part of the celebration, bless you, right? In that way that, you know, drinking is communal and social. So if we're all sitting down at the table and one person's not drinking, they're kind of bummed out. And what we teach our people to do is to listen. I said, so what's going on table 34? Like, there's no glass. And she says, oh, well, she's not drinking. So I said, I don't care. Put a glass down and I'll go pour something for her, right? Because it's the part about social drinking, about drinking is social. Think about the person who doesn't drink and then, you know, and she's sober, that person's sober. They hate being out with friends that have been drinking because they're not on the same level. So, yes.
But I want to give a huge round of applause.
I don't know. Thank you.